are starting the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at MysticPete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interview Michael Ravenwood about Skyfire Arts and his Climate Change Arts Festival. And then we hear some music by Kaztek, Come to Get Funky. Stay tuned! It is September 9th, 2023. Mystic Pete here with Michael Ravenwood.
Hello!
Skyfire Arts. We are old friends and artist collaborators and activists and just kind of a couple of neat dudes sitting in my studio. Hi!
Hi!
Introduce yourself and tell me a little about what you're doing.
Okay, so I am a performing artist and a workshop presenter speaker. I have a company called Skyfire Arts, as you said, in which we wear high-voltage protective suits, become electrified by giant devices known as Tesla coils, and throw bolts of lightning as part of our show. And that's all very spectacular and everything, but what we're really excited about in the company is using that to draw attention to ecological awareness and renewable energy. And, you know, there's a number of different ways to look at those terms. You know, ecological awareness we use as a phrase specifically because it's a scientific representation of something that mystics and shamans have talked about for thousands of years, which is essentially that everything is connected and that consciousness is somehow a bridging, or awareness is somehow a bridging element or medium in which all reality exists. And so ecological awareness, you know, or, you know, biology, quantum physics, these are all branches of science that have, you know, gone down the road of exploring physically, like how is that connection mediated? And it's really proven that we are essentially just the Earth that's evolved and evolved into these, you know, biological organisms that speak and dance and sing to each other. But we're the Earth, and we're what the Earth has done to itself. So we like to promote that idea because we feel like the paradigm shift between looking at ourselves as separate from the environment or the ecology and needing to control it or, rest it and make it do our whims, you know, that the paradigm shift between looking at things that way and looking at things as all being connected and us just being part of it, that's the primary thing that's going to help us as humans survive this next phase of cultural evolution. And then renewable energy is like acting as if that connection is real. And there's a couple of different branches to that. So renewable energy is typically seen as like availing ourselves of the energy raining down freely from the sun, or, you know, from the kinetic energy of the waves moving in and out, the geothermal energy, wind power, like all these are sustainable, like renewable forms of energy outside of ourselves in the environment that we can avail ourselves of and you know, use to drive our culture. But there's another form of renewable energy we can look at as coming from within us. And a lot of people call that, and I like to call that love. It's the love that we have for the people around us and the love that we have for the things that we do that really fill us with joy when we're in our passions. And when we're connected to that love, we get a free energy from within us. We are part of the natural environment. And so the natural energy that rains down from the sun, there's an analogy within us. The love sort of radiates from us. So when we connect to what it is that we love, we can do it for hours and hours effortlessly. And it's like a renewable or sustainable form of energy from within. And if we can connect to something that we love that creates value for the world, that other people love, then we're sort of completing that cycle of love and, you know, completing what I call the human energy circuit. Of course, we have, you know, throwing lightning and using electricity. We have all these electrical metaphors in our workshops and whatnot. So that's completing the human energy circuit in the sense that by plugging into the universe's free source of energy, the love we have, and creating something of value that somebody else is then loving and happy to pay us for, then we can use that money to sustain ourselves physically, we can make a living from it, then we've sort of set ourselves up in a circumstance where we can play for the rest of our lives. We can do what we love and make a living. And so we like to promote that as well as, you know, renewable sources of energy outside of us. So that's kind of the, you know, the thing that we're most excited about is using the spectacle of this performance to draw attention to ecological awareness or unity consciousness, whatever you call it, and renewable energy in all its forms.
So, in other words, I'm actually just this skin meat bag full of squishy, wet Earth walking around. I just always knew something about my life was a little yeah, that's what it is. Okay, good. Yes, we are Earth. We are Earth, but that has somehow taken on mobility and consciousness and reproduction, and we're almost at the point of despoiling the entire environment because we're getting a little carried away, and we have to be a little bit more mindful and figure out how to be graceful and gracious on this planet without exhausting its resources. Mm-hmm. And you're making the connection between your art form, where you're taking literal electric energy and performing with it, which we'll talk about in a minute, and the overall energy of the Earth, and metaphorically, the energy of consciousness and love.
Indeed. Yep. So, yeah, the characters on stage, the way we sort of tie it into the storytelling, is that the characters on stage are the guardians of Threya. And Threya is a world of this parallel dimension to our own. And if you mix up the letters of the word Earth, you can get Threya. And so,
Okay,
so there's this, obviously, this parallel. And in that world, just like here, there are certain beings that are living in harmony with nature, and then there are others that are not so much. And so my attempt with my artistic expression is to represent, what do the characters that live in harmony with nature sound like? What do they move like? What motivates them? And what are their thoughts? And what's their mindset? And so the characters in our show, they communicate telepathically with the audience, and they share with them these ideas which reflect unity consciousness or ecological awareness, whatever you want to call it. And they also reflect this idea of guardianship, that we want to protect our mother planet, but not because we're afraid of something, but because we love. And it's this connection of being a guardian, not out of resentment or anger, but really out of a sense of love for those that we care about and that we're ready to fight. But we also realize, like, everything's just going to go to dust eventually anyway. So it's really kind of okay that ultimately everything will just go back into this recreative cycle, this rebirth cycle. But why not protect it while it's here? Why not relish in it and really show our appreciation and our gratitude by protecting it and by doing things, you know, that will help maintain it, its beauty and its grace. And part of that, too, is that trying to force others to act in the ways that we think that they should towards the Earth or otherwise is not really a sustainable, you know, answer or a sustainable option for us. What we really want to do is help inspire them to understand why it's actually in their interests to protect the planet. And so that's also what we do with our events, is we have these opportunities for people to engage with ecological lifestyle in a way that benefits them. It's not just like, you ought to be kind to the planet because you're really being bad otherwise. It's more like, hey, save money or even make money and protect the planet. Here's how. You know, and then people go, oh. And another angle that we take is that, you know, people don't generally care about their neighbors, never mind something so abstract as the planet, if they aren't really happy with their own lives or if they don't feel abundant enough to have bandwidth to care about others. And so what we really want to teach people, which unfortunately we're not really taught in school as a standard practice, is what it takes to be happy. Like, every single human being wants to be happy, and it's kind of the most basic fundamental need outside of food, clothing, and shelter. But people will even go without food and clothing and shelter to be happy or to do things that make them happy. So really it's happiness we're all looking for. And there's a lot of scientific research now on what makes people happy, what determines whether a person is happy or not in their life. So we want to help people. I teach, you know, breath work, meditation, visualization, all these different, you know, journaling, different techniques to examine our lives and learn, you know, what it is that really helps us be happy. And then, you know, from that position of abundance, we can give out of a sense of, you know, like, oh, I can give because I'm happy, I'm full, my cup is full, not out of a sense of obligation, which is usually how people end up in resentment, is giving out of obligation, yeah.
Well, interesting point there, because I came from a very activist family, very left-leaning, progressive family. My early days of activism were on picket lines, going door-to-door, getting signatures to get initiatives on the ballot, campaigning for candidates, passing laws, very direct kind of political action that's, you know, more like the legit kind of way to engage with the political process. And believe me, I've spent plenty of hours on picket lines, you know, yelling at people if I needed to try to make some kind of impact on the world. And I think that kind of engagement has its place and is very important, because actual laws need to be signed that protect the environment, protect workers' rights, protect people in the minority and women's rights and so forth. And we need people in Congress and in the halls of power who are honest people who care about the world and are not just bought off by the big money interests. So I've spent a lot of time in that world. And as I say, it is important. But in the last couple of decades, certainly, my involvement in activism has been breathed into the arts. And it's often cloaked. It's often a subtext. It's often not spoken of directly. But you think of John Lennon and his song Imagine. So here's one song that perhaps has changed the consciousness of the planet more or as much as anything else that anybody has ever done, listening to this song, which isn't campaigning for any candidate. So I think the arts are a legitimate and very valuable tool and vehicle for people to become involved and for a more generalized shifting of awareness towards compassion, towards being mindful of the planet, ecological awareness, and so forth. And it sounds like you're very deeply in this process of using the arts to shift the consciousness of the world, as opposed to being on picket lines and yelling at people.
Indeed. Well, you know, I agree and acknowledge that both are important and have their place, and that people often in various parts of their life will find different of these activities, like the thing that they love and the thing that feels good to them and the way that they can express their energy in a way that aligns with their intention and their purpose. And, you know, in that, you know, specifically political sphere, I feel that climate change activism does relate to that, you know, specifically in the realm of anti-corruption. And I personally, you know, love represent.us as a bipartisan organization that, you know, does its best to essentially address, you know, something that does relate to climate change, but proximally. And that's in that most people at this point recognize that climate change is a huge issue. And if you ask them individually, you know, hey, do you think that we should make more policies and laws, you know, reflect this understanding that we need to change the way we're behaving as a culture, or else there's going to be a lot of consequences? Most people at this point would say yes, but there's a very important, I believe it was a Yale study that, it might have been Princeton, but it was a study which demonstrated that in the United States, essentially, there is zero correlation between public opinion and whether or not laws get passed. And it just shows fundamentally that our democracy is broken and that, you know, there still is this structure that we might revitalize. And that's what represent.us is all about, is all about finding how we can begin to, and that's why it's called represent.us. It's like, we want our government to represent us and represent our desires and our wants. And one of those is that, again, if you poll Americans, they want climate change to be addressed. Because they recognize, you know, 99% of climate scientists are all like, yeah, we've studied it. This is what's happening. We need to address it right away, you know. And so, you know, in addressing climate change, it is such a large and multifaceted issue. I think political things are very important to acknowledge and to address. And in that's why in my, you know, in my personal life, I support represent.us and those kinds of actions, more, you know, direct political actions. But as you say, the arts are a very powerful, if more indirect and subtle way to have political action, that if you basically, as the song Imagine that John Lennon wrote, you know, influences the awareness of people, you have people themselves, you know, represent and, you know, and begin to act in alignment with the kinds of awareness that are going to create the policies that we want to see in the future and that will address climate change. So yeah, so in my art form or whatnot, in the you know, performing arts show that we do, those characters on stage are from this parallel world, and they, you know, speak as the people who live in harmony with nature would speak, and they encourage people to adopt the kinds of mindset that will not only empower them as people, but also, you know, lead them to act in ways that are, you know, more ecologically aware and in alignment with ecological lifestyle. So, you know, that is kind of the first layer, but there's only so much you can do in like 10-20 minute show to really transform people's consciousness, right? And until we develop our full 60-90 minute show, you know, I know that most of the work is going to be needing to be done in like the form of talks and workshops where people can get deeper into these ideas. And so I'm relying on the fact that people who are fascinated by the show itself, just drawn by the beacon of the lightning and the fire and the LED performance, they'll, when they hear those ideas, they might think, wow, these are really cool ideas. Like, who are these people? Who are these artists? And as they explore it further, they explore Skyfire Arts is actually backed by Skyfire Academy. And so the academy is where I teach workshops or do presentations. And like I said, I teach, you know, the breath work, meditation, other kinds of techniques to connect us to unity consciousness and the kind of lifestyle that empowers us. And then Skyfire Lifestyle is where we have, you know, a bunch of partners, because we're not going to also go out and start making electric cars or putting in solar in people's houses. We make the, you know, partnerships with these other organizations that we can connect people to so they can make substantive changes in their lives. So I'm not only trying to just subtly affect people through the art, but I'm trying to draw them deeper into transforming their lifestyle through these other branches of the company.
Well, we're in a situation in civilization where a lot of people, if you ask them, they say, I'm apolitical. I don't get involved. I don't vote. In fact, they're proud of not voting because they're not part of that corrupt system. So there's that apathy or nihilism. And then there's the situation where everybody's positional and polarized and screaming at each other and hardening in their position. And then there's one other part of it, that the predatory forces have gotten so good at, well, two things. One, making people suspicious of legitimate media and science. So a lot of people now go, oh, don't watch mainstream mass media because it's all a lie. So that's a success for the predatory forces. Then people can't find out what's actually happening in the world. They don't know the facts of reality. So all of facts now become questionable, not trusting anything except trust me. I'm the guy with the answer, the predatory guy. So they've been very successful. Oh, and then there's one last thing that the predatory people are doing. They've gotten very good at using the language of activism to represent whatever corrupt thing they're promoting. They're like the Borg. They like absorb these words that forward-thinking progressive people use, that language. They absorb it and then they mutate it. And then they turn around and then they attack with it. So it's an extremely complicated time and a confusing time of humanity. And I think for all of these reasons, perhaps the arts are a really important vehicle to help advance us, because there's no obvious agenda. There's nobody screaming for their point of view. There's no necessarily even political party. It's just do the art, and then it's back on us as artists to infuse the work with power and consciousness and perhaps political messages and messages about the earth, so people are lifted up and they're more aware, and then hopefully they can make the jump to doing actually responsible things in reality, passing laws and electing people.
So what you're pointing out here is that there is a, you know, kind of a distinction between revolution and renaissance. That revolution is this more direct, you know, kind of action that you might take, and you might end up using force, because things get to a point where if you're not going to use force, then you're going to be forced. And that, you know, there are times in history where that has come down, but that when in history we've watched that play itself out, the French Revolution, and, you know, many different circumstances, you know, the
American Revolution.
Yeah. You know, basically, when a revolution happens, quite frequently, the people that end up taking over, even though originally their ideology might have been more, you know, in integrity with what the people actually want, later on, when they get in power, they just end up turning into very much the same kind of power structures that existed before, but using different terms, and, you know, but using the same kind of oppression, ultimately.
By the way, so, I have to interrupt, because the research I've read shows that most rebellions and revolutions are not caused by the underclass and people who are being oppressed. They're usually initiated by people who were entitled, people who were in power and are losing that or have lost that power. And those are the people who start rebellions. So anyway,
fascinating. Yeah. I didn't know that. Yeah. So, you know, it's not a surprise then.
And we can see that happening right now in the United States. Mm-hmm. The old power structure is starting to lose its grip on the entitlement that they had. And they're starting to scream and yell and act like spoiled brats and being violent.
Mm. Yeah. And so, you know, the other alternative is Renaissance. You know, how do you transform the awareness of the people in the culture such that they, from within, want to adopt more egalitarian structures, want to, you know, have more, you know, have policies enacted which are more respectful to the environment because they care about future generations. We care about what the world's going to look like for our children and their children. And so, you know, an artistic expression can more effectively, you know, create a renaissance where from within people just naturally start acting a different way instead of having a gun held to their head and have to act in a certain way. That is until, of course, they can get away with acting like another way, and in which case they do that. So renaissance is really ultimately, I feel like, the only way we can create lasting transformation and change when we have that process of thesis, then antithesis, and then synthesis, and ultimately people realize, oh, okay, you know, the original way of thinking had some valuable things. This new way of thinking has valuable things. How do we find a place where the value of both of those ways of thinking can be creating a new structure that then is more relevant to what's going on in our current world? And so, you know, as we emerge with AI and biotech and all these different things, like, into a new way of being as humans, like, we get to envision, like, wow, how does this happen? Like, how do we still have the kinds of technologies, or at least have the effects of the technologies that we've created, but have them in a way that's more closely aligned with natural forces? One of the most exciting things that I heard recently is that people are using, like, fungus to grow furniture instead of, like, having to cut down trees and shape them and do all whatever and transport them. That you can actually just grow furniture. You can, like, use these now, or there's fungus that, and mushrooms or whatever, that eat oil spills and can be used to clean up toxic waste. And there's all these different ways of, like, finding technologies that are in alignment with nature. And when I wrote, you know, the mythology of the Guardians of Threa, I talked about, you know, and I wrote about how instead of, like, you know, they still had technology as these beings that are in harmony with nature, but their technology is different. Like, for example, they sing to the spiders, and the spiders just weave cloth for them because they create this certain, you know, undulation with their voice. And, you know, anyway, I came up with these things, and lo and behold, now there's certain technologies like growing furniture and things like that. I was just like, wow, that's awesome that, you know, this sort of bit. And a lot of science fiction is like that, right? Like, the science fiction writers will write these things, and then scientists will, that's a great idea, and then they actually go create the science to, or create the technology to actualize what it is science fiction writers were doing. And so, you know, I feel really great about being one of the artists that is just looking at the world that we have right now, looking at the technologies developed, and therefore what kind of a world we might live in the future. And then just trying to create these stories of, like, oh, okay, if one of the issues we're running up against has a solution like universal basic income, yet we've also found that, like, you know, indigenous leaders and civil rights leaders have also recognized how if you just give handouts to this entire culture or subculture, you'll often cripple them or create, you know, ruin upon them because you're undermining the very kind of self-respect people have from earning what it is that they get. You know, you wanna try and balance those. So maybe a structure could look like, instead of universal basic income just being something you receive, maybe it could be universal basic contribution. Everybody goes to their decentralized local area where there's a garden and there's, you know, home building centers or whatever, where you literally contribute a certain amount of your time to food, clothing, and shelter, providing that for your community and yourself. And then if you log a certain number of hours, boom, suddenly you get, like, you can go to your local food distribution center and you can just receive food and you can receive clothing and all these different things, so that there's this exchange of energy that's taking place. And because, you know, self-respect isn't something that you can buy. A lot of wealthy people find that, you know, they might have done a lot of difficult things in order to find, you know, their way into this wealthy circumstance, but then if they get that wealth, and then they suddenly surround themselves with comfort and more comfort, one of the ironic things that happens is that our baseline of expectation moves. So then if you are used to everything coming to you right away, anytime you want it, then the very slightest delay in your pleasure suddenly becomes this tremendous annoyance. I've experienced it when waiting in line behind someone, suddenly they ask about the menu. And then they're talking about the menu. And all of a sudden I find myself very irritated. I'm like, why am I so angry right now? It's like, oh, it's because I'm used to just everything coming to me all the time. And so, you know, having this situation where people surround themselves with comfort because they have wealth, they actually disconnect from self-respect, because self-respect isn't something you can buy. It's something that only, it's a sense that only comes to you if you do difficult things and succeed. If you keep doing things that make you feel awkward, that make you feel challenged, but then you get through that, then you just get this sense of like, yeah, I'm capable. I can make things happen. But if you just give people everything that they need all the time without them having to do anything, maybe there are some people, maybe through being taught, you know, a certain work ethic or whatever it is, that will continue to drive themselves to do difficult things. But a lot of other people, their natural mechanism that forces people into circumstances where they develop self-respect, that is sort of undermined. So then, you know, again, I'm just saying, in the creation of my art, I get to play with these ideas of what does the world where we have such amazing technology that all of our needs could be taken care of, what does that world look like? And how does the universal experience of being human play into that? And where do we find harmony with nature, even with this powerful technology?
I appreciate how the conversation is expanding, and it highlights a point I want to make, that it's not possible right now for changes to happen through violence or revolution or actual physical rebellion, because technology is so advanced right now and so dangerous that even small groups of people can, you know, destroy the whole world. In other words, it's too dangerous now for a war to happen to make things better. If the change happens through violence, we're all gone. It's extinction. So it's not possible to do it that way. The only possible way that we're going to get through this and mature and grow up is a species, is through ideas and creativity and the arts. And so the place of the visionary and the artist becomes very important. I mean, that is the only way we can move forward. If it goes back to the animal way of might makes right, we're dead. Mm-hmm. So that's not this conversation may be more important than we realize right now. We're just a couple artists in LA talking about it, but like, if we look back in 50 years, they may go, oh yeah, you guys had the answer. And I really think we do, whether it's spiders weaving clothes or fungus creating furniture, By the way, which you can use in your pasta sauce too. Makes a very nice porcini sauce. Or as you were talking about decentralized distribution. I mean, these are all ideas. And it's these ideas which will ultimately be very powerful and lead us to some kind of revelation. I mean, it may be that you, Michael Ravenwood, comes up with some idea that's just so on it, on point, and revelatory, and like world-changing that everybody goes, oh, that solves the whole thing. Oh, let's do it that way. And then, you know, next week or next month, everything shifts in the world. Why not? Does it all have to be through this brutality and everybody grabbing the most they can? That's the end of the world if we think it's going to happen that way by, you know, consuming our way to success. It's just not possible. We're all overextended in every possible system. We're right at the edge right now. So it has to come through creative thinking and new ideas and new attempts. Mm. And here we are, a couple of people on the edge of that journey, just talking about it. And maybe in this conversation, we'll figure out the whole world.
Well, at some point or another throughout history, it was always some group of people that came up with the idea or set of ideas that led to the next iteration of human culture. And what's fascinating is that this process that we're talking about, this artistic process, is something that has gone on over and over and over again throughout history. And there was a man named Joseph Campbell, who's so brilliant. He basically, you know, is a scholar, and he analyzed the storytelling of cultures around the world throughout history. And he found that there's this basically a universal template of the human story. And he called it the hero's journey. And he wrote a book called The Hero, the Journey, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And it's about this hero's journey in which we all really participate, where, you know, in our lives, you know, things are fine for a while, or they seem fine, and then something happens. And what previously was okay, or, you know, the pattern that seemed to be working is not working anymore. And then at that point, there's basically two branches of the story. All the different cultures have different ways of telling this, that either the hero willingly goes on the journey of discovering the new thing that's going to help things go back to stasis, homeostasis, or synergy or symbiosis, or they're dragged kicking and screaming. Like, there's only two choices. Like, things have changed. You're going to need to find a new way. You're either going willingly or you're dragged, right? And then along this journey, you have certain allies you find, certain adversaries, and ultimately you come to a point where you're not quite sure if you can go on. And everything is so difficult, and it's called the dark night of the soul. And we've all experienced, at some point in our lives, we live long enough, a dark night of the soul where, you know, there's a death and rebirth, whether it's a literal one. There's like in the stories, there's a literal death and rebirth sometimes. But otherwise, it's just, you know, you go into this underworld and you face this, you know, difficulty, which is so tremendous that you are transformed by moving through it. And then if you make it out of that, or if you're reborn from it, then you have some sort of special power or special knowledge with which you go back to your previous culture, and either they accept you happily and you're the new hero of your culture and you transform everything, or they reject you because you're in this new way that they don't recognize, and, you know, they are unable to deal with your new power, new knowledge, and you have to go on to a new culture or off into the sunset or whatever it is. So this universal human story apparently just has to be retold every generation or every few generations. There has to be a new way of telling the story so it's relevant to the current generation growing up. Because it's impossible to really tell a child, like, be humble. It's important to be humble if the child doesn't really know what humble is or doesn't have any reference point for humble. But if you say to them, there was once a boy, and this boy thought he knew everything, and he went charging off to the, and then he got smacked down. But then he recognized that there was things for him to learn, and he was taught by these people, and then once he learned from these people, then he was empowered, he could do the thing to, and then that tells the story of humility. And then all of a sudden the brain somehow, you know, through the storytelling technology is what I call it, you know, because technology is not just an external device. It can be an internal device, or it can be any kind of device for accomplishing, you know, a desired goal or outcome. And so storytelling is what I call a technology of consciousness. It's the way that we have instilled values into people generation after generation for thousands of years. that is how we get our motivation. And to me, that's like really the value that we're trying to bring to the space of climate change as Skyfire Arts, is that we don't lack the technology to affect climate change or to come into harmony with the planet. We have plenty of technologies right now that if we implemented them, they would bring us, you know, way closer, if not already, to drawdown, which is the process by which we go back to this, you know, planetary homeostasis where the planet's temperature is at a good state. You know, it's motivation. People are not motivated to use these technologies or to use these lifestyle practices. And so if the issue is not technology, it's motivation, we get to ask ourselves, well, where does motivation come from? Well, it comes from our values. You know, some might say, oh, it comes from biological drives, food, clothing, shelter. But people will go without food, clothing, and shelter to serve their values all the time. They'll even die, you know, to preserve these values they find important. So if motivation comes from values, where do our values come from? They come from the stories we believe. If we believe a story that a diamond is valuable and we giving it to a loved one shows our love for them, then we'll go to the ends of the earth to work tirelessly for years to buy this diamond for our loved one. But if we believe that a handwritten card is more valuable and more personal and intimate, you know, then we just, you know, we'll never get a die. Diamond is a thing you might as well leave on the ground. You just give person a personal, and hopefully the person you love feels the same way about the card, right? But my point is that if really it's a issue of climate change, an issue of motivation, and that comes from values, you know, then where the values come from are stories. And so we need to tell people the stories that in a certain sense they already know are true. And then, you know, in the backs of their minds, they really understand, oh yeah, this universal human story of coming to awareness and coming to, like, it just makes sense to be good. You know, if you're wicked, you might temporarily win, you might gain advantage over people around you, but ultimately, you'll never be able to trust any of the people around you because they know you would lie to them if you get an advantage out of it. And they know that you've just cut down everyone around you to get what it is that you want, so why shouldn't they do the same? And so you can never really ultimately win, meaning living a life of beauty and grace and trust and love and intimacy, by being wicked. Really, it just makes sense to be good. And we can accomplish more by cooperating than any individual can do for themselves. And so if we're telling people this story, and to some degree they're going to recognize the truth of it. So the bottom line is that if we can, as artists, tell the story that will instill the values which will motivate people to act in alignment with ecological principles, then we are effecting the change that we want to see in the world sort of from within the people that we influence. And like I said, like, these principles, even though new ideas of how to implement them need to be found with each successive generation that's relevant to the technological environment that's going on, the essential sort of truths about what it is to be human are, you know, you could say eternal. I don't know, as bioscience, transforms us from within, maybe that will change. But essentially, for thousands and thousands of years, that whole piece around self-respect, for example, that it is a thing that we need to earn, it is not a thing we can buy. You know, that is a universal human experience. And the experience that, you know, if things get too easy for us, then our sort of baseline of expectations shifts. And so we come to just expect everything to be just as good as it has been or as it is now. And we don't find any pleasure unless we have at least as much as we have now, if not more. That universal experience of, oh, if I intentionally challenge myself, if I intentionally put myself into awkward and difficult circumstances, then I actually change my baseline of expectation. And when I have pleasurable experiences, I feel them all the more. Now, the whole practice of Tantra, you know, has a large piece of that in it, that we can't just pleasure ourselves and pleasure ourselves and pleasure, because it's like eating a bowl of ice cream. You know, if you have a huge bowl of ice cream, the first few bites are amazing. They're just the best thing that ever found its way in your mouth, right? But then a few more bites and it's pretty good. It's really good. You know, by the end of the last few bites of a bowl of ice cream, aren't you kind of just trying to shovel them in there, like get onto the next thing you're doing? What changed, right? It's not the ice cream. It's our experience of the ice cream. And so these kinds of universal human experiences of, oh, like, I need to limit the amount of pleasure or whatnot that I give to myself to some degree so that I really experience that pleasure when I have it. That's universal. If we can tell these stories in a way where people are like, oh yeah, that is kind of true, you know? Like I told a story just now of eating a bowl of ice cream that probably a lot of people here in the West at least are familiar with, you know? And then you can convey that understanding of, oh yeah, that is what it is to be human, and I need to pay attention to these things. And then when we do, we find our way to happiness more clearly, and then again, we can care about those around us in our environment if we are truly happy. So as I was saying, it's essentially my goal as an artist to help in this, you know, ages-long process of retelling the universal story of what it is to be human in a way that's culturally relevant. So the characters that are in this, you know, world called Threya in a parallel dimension, they're dealing with some of the same technological contexts that we are in our world, and that's how it kind of becomes relevant to the people that live today. But the universal, you know, tone of their experience as people is unchanged, and so people will find connection to it and relevancy in their lives in that way as well.
Beautifully put. Well, let me connect a couple of dots here, and then let's talk about the actual experience you're about to put on that puts it all together. So you've been talking about this process of myth-making, storytelling. It's an archetypical process, Jungian, looking at the symbolic nature of reality. And, you know, some people might say, yeah, you can't solve world problems this way, this hippy-dippy dreamer reality with the Thrugleville stories. I'm sorry. What's the name of it?
Oh, the Threya.
Yeah, okay. Like, this is just, like, silly. Like, unless we, you know, get
pragmatic and practical.
Unless we get pragmatic, practical solutions, nothing's going to change. But we're coming up with this idea, well, maybe first something else has to happen or in concert with those practical actions. Because we're seeing right now the consequences on planet Earth of the old consciousness. This might makes right, law of the jungle, take as much as you can get away with and hoard and grab everything. And $1 billion isn't enough. We need $100 billion. And then bunkering ourselves down in big palatial estates. At least that's the dream. That's what everybody wants, right? But if you look at people who are hoarding all this wealth, or just even people of modest means who are trying to collect as much as they can, it's generally a very isolating, lonely existence. I'm sure all these billionaires surrounded by sycophants and all kinds of trinkets and gold sparkly things, you know, there's a real loneliness about that existence. Not to mention the millions and millions of people who have, who have enough stuff, but we're lonely. Now, one way to solve it, well, in LA, you have like a couple million people. Well, we could just double the amount of people, so there's 4 million. So then certainly we won't be lonely with all those more people. Or perhaps actually more people and more things won't solve it. There actually has to be a shift of consciousness, of dreams, of heart towards things we're talking about, and even towards things like personal sacrifice. Instead of grabbing as much as we can, well, showing up for other people. I mean, every time I give to someone else and make some kind of sacrifice, I feel good. You know, maybe it's not about grabbing so much, it's about giving more instead of hunkering down and being suspicious of everybody is actually extending yourself. But that's kind of a progressive idea these days. That's almost a radical idea. In fact, the old kind of baboon consciousness, to those people, that's like communism. Like tolerance and diversity and being kind to each other. That's selling out. That's Marxism, fascism, communism, and everything evil all bundled into one thing, because they only see the answer as one of aggression and not compromising and doubling down with violence and their own positionality. So even this like idea of being tolerant, being nice to people, is already like this radical left-wing political idea. Things have gotten so polarized. So, but I'm saying this is the only solution, actually. New ideas, new dreams, and then the most abstract level. And then that filters down to, well, something that you're going to produce in a few weeks in San Diego. So this is an actual arts event oriented around the environment, but literally doing things that symbolically represent the kind of shifts we need. You're going to be playing with electricity and energy. I mean, these are actually topics we have to solve in the world. And through this fun, playful, artistic, musical event, maybe people go, oh, you know, being involved with the world isn't so bad. Maybe I can vote. Maybe I can be involved in an actual more pragmatic way because, oh yeah, this may, like, you bring people in a way that's accessible to them through just a fun, entertaining experience, but that has a lot of meaning underneath. So talk about your event.
Absolutely. Thank you. So I want to touch upon the whole piece you said about personal sacrifice and how important it is ultimately to be happy, to actually be giving to other people, and how there is this sort of universal recognition across cultures that it is at a certain point when you have gained enough for yourself and you've, you know, worked and oriented your actions around accumulating enough resources for you to be stable and for your loved ones to be protected, that once you achieve that point, the more and more you accumulate, the more and more it seems to like weigh you down. You just have more things to worry about. You just, you know, it's this thing where at first you have to build a platform to stand on. And if you don't have at least enough food, clothing, and shelter, you know, regularly, you know, present in your life, you're going to feel insecure and there's going to be challenges being happy. But then when you get to that point, when you do have enough, if you just keep accumulating more and more without sacrificing some of what you could have for yourself for the benefit of others, then it actually makes you more and more miserable because of that point I made regarding, well, if you create more and more comfort, then that challenge, which resets your expectation level, doesn't happen. And so actually there are different kinds of chemicals in our brain that create the pleasures that we have. Four of the primary ones are endorphins, dopamine, serotonin, and oxytocin, right? And dopamine and endorphins are chemicals that can be really achieved by our own actions. So endorphins, I don't need anybody to get endorphins. I can scratch my scalp, I can run, go on a run, and I can get these good feelings by just doing something independent. Dopamine, I can make a list of things to do, go do something, check it off, do something, check it off, and I get these hits of dopamine every time I check it off, and I feel good, right? But then there are the pleasure chemicals which come from our interactions with others that we can't really get from doing things ourselves. For example, the oxytocin we get from looking in someone else's eyes or giving them a hug, or even more profoundly through serotonin, if we watch someone else we care about having something beautiful happen to them, we suddenly get a rush of serotonin. We get this pleasure chemical, not from something that happens to us, but by seeing it happen to someone else, even some stranger. We might feel a connection or some empathy for them, and then something beautiful happens for them. Well, we make them smile. We pay, you know, give them an extra good tip, or we pay for somebody's coffee behind us without them knowing us. And we see the joy in their eyes when that happens. We feel good too. So this whole idea of personal sacrifice being tied into our own ultimate happiness is a very important one that is part of the universal human story of what it is to find fulfillment or to find happiness. And we want to convey that, you know, through our storytelling, through our workshops, and, you know, ultimately, as you mentioned, at this event that we're producing, where we'll be able to basically showcase everything that I've been talking about all this time. So the bottom line is that, you know, October 7th in San Diego, we're producing this event, which is an all-day long kind of, it's kind of a micro festival where, in the daytime, we will have workshops where we want to make fitness fun. And so we have these family-friendly workshops. People can learn to spin a hoop or spin a staff and do it with their kids and enjoy the process of becoming fit and doing something joyful, you know, with their kids. You can actually have your fitness with your kids. You don't have to pay for a gym membership necessarily. Kids have tons of energy. If you just get them with a stick or a hoop and you just play with them for a while, suddenly you're sweating and you're getting what it is that you need while they're getting what they need, and this joyful activity around dancing. So we're offering people this, hey, fitness, something many people will look at as being arduous or whatever, fitness can be fun. And then we all have all these presentations about how being ecologically aware and active can actually save you money, or actually can make you money, or it can be something you really feel good about because you're protecting the future generations, your children and their children. And so we really want to reorient people's ideas of, okay, what is it to look at climate change? Usually when people look at climate change, they're like, oh, it's so depressing, it's so overwhelming, it's like, what can I really do? But, you know, for example, our main keynote speaker is from Project Drawdown, and they're an organization addressing climate change in a very, like, powerful and sort of unique way. Paul Hawken, who is the person who started the project, Project Drawdown, he did a study around what are the most leveraged things we can do to address climate change, because everybody kind of feels generally like, wow, this is such a huge problem, so complex, so deep, so, you know, far-reaching. How can I make a difference? And so he went and he said, okay, let's talk about this, because if we're going to have to make the most impact in the littlest amount of time, we're going to have to know, you know, what is going to be effective and the most effective in the shortest period of time. So Project Drawdown is, you know, doing a presentation. Their communications director, Skylar Knight, is doing a presentation on what are the most powerful ways that we each individually can address climate change in our lives and change our story of what the climate is to us, or what climate change into us, and, you know, or what it is to us, and, you know, create a success story out of it rather than this depressing thing. So he and other speakers, for example, we're having someone come out and do a talk on how sustainability is sexy, and another person come out, John Halcyon is going to come out and do a talk on, you know, joyful activism. How does one be an activist but take a joyful, positive perspective toward it? So we really want to make, you know, fitness, we want to make environmental concerns and ecological awareness, we want to make it fun, we want to make it enjoyable, a positive process where we can really feel good about it. So that's during the day, from about 12:45 to 5. And also during that time, there's going to be something that I believe is the most unique, perhaps, that we're offering at our event. No time in history has anyone ever offered an event where someone can basically get in a suit and throw lightning. And so I'm going to be teaching a workshop on, you know, Tesla coil lightning performance and safety, and people are going to get a chance to get in the suit and throw lightning. So that's really exciting, along with other kinds of immersion experiences. So that happens during the day. Then 5 p.m. to 7, we'll have a dance party. And then at 7 o'clock, there will be our main show. I wanted to do it early because, you know, I wanted the children to be able to come. Kids just go bananas over the show. And so the whole daytime is, you know, for adults and children to enjoy. And then around 7 when we do our show, it'll kind of, convert into a nighttime, you know, dance party, essentially. So the whole thing is noon to 1 a.m. And then from, you know, 7:30 when our show is done until 1, it'll be DJs and more Tesla and fire and LED performances. So it's really, you know, an event where there'll be things for younger people as well as for, you know, people with children and families. So I'm really excited about presenting this experience for everyone.
Where's the website they can find out about it more?
So the website is skyfirearts.com/infinite-energy, infinite-energy at the end of skyfirearts.com. And that's, you know, for people to watch the video about what's going to be at this event. I'm super grateful to the whole team for doing everything they're doing to pull this together. It's the realization of a dream I've had for over a decade.
Or just search Skyfire Arts Infinite Energy. Beginning of October 2023. Michael Ravenwood, it has certainly been a joy, and I hope we can keep this conversation. This is our second interview. We will do this again.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you so much, Peter. Give me up.
Yes, y'all, it's the one and only. Get up.
We are coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interviewed Michael Ravenwood about Skyfire Arts and his Climate Change Arts Festival. We just wrapped things up with a tune by Kaz Tech, Come to Get Funky. We'll be back next week with the best of talk radio. Mystic Pete out! Thank you.